Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Saturday, April 27th. All materials heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Justin Gibson, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Ella Gibson. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and Dear Abby. The third hour continues with more sports and lighter news. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. So high for today is going to be 76 degrees with a low of 62. Thunderstorms still likely today with winds out of the southwest 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tomorrow, a high of 74 and a low of 48. Still showers and heavy thunderstorms expected. And here for your first article from the Des Moines Register is Ella.
Ex-Simpson professor gets 10 years in husband's death. A former Simpson College professor will spend up to 10 years in prison after pleading guilty to manslaughter and kidnapping in the 2020 death of her husband, who police say was strangled while gagged and tied to a chair. Gowan Park appeared before Judge Brad McCall on Thursday to enter her plea, the result of a deal reached with Dallas County prosecutors. Had she been convicted at trial of the original charge of first-degree murder for the death of Sung Woo Nam, she would have faced life in prison. Instead, she pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter, third-degree kidnapping, and domestic abuse by strangulation. At Thursday's hearing, prosecutors argued the sentences for those crimes should run consecutively, for a total of 25 years. McCall instead granted the request of Park's attorney, allowing them to run concurrently. There is, in this court's opinion, clear evidence Ms. Park was a victim of domestic violence both at the hands of her father and thereafter at the hands of her husband, McCall said. Park, who immigrated from South Korea, spent most of the hours-long hearing staring down, occasionally wiping her eyes, and wept and trembled when she read a statement telling the judge that I will spend the rest of my life feeling the pain of my husband's death. Prosecutors, though, said Park was the abuser, and Nam's family told the court they'd watched Park financially exploit, lie to, and isolate Nam before his death. Honorable Judge McCall, I beg you to please see the heart of a mother who could not protect or save her son, as he was unfairly and unjustly murdered, Nam's mother, Bong Nam, wrote in a statement read by her daughter. According to court filings, Park, 45, told officers responding to a 911 call from her West Des Moines condominium on the night of her husband's death that he was abusive and had given her permission to tie him up when he became violent. On Thursday, Dallas County Attorney Janine Ritchie shared additional details, saying Park told detectives Nam, 41, had a history of violence against her and their property, and that earlier on February 15th, he had damaged the windshield of their car in an outburst of temper. Park told police she had bound Park to the chair and checked back on him an hour later, finding him not breathing. Officers later obtained two videos from Park's phone. One taken days before his death showed Nam kneeling and giving permission for his hands and feet to be bound at Park's prompting. The other showed Nam bound and tied to the chair, gagged and blindfolded, as Park is heard blaming him for doing something on purpose. Nam, through the gag, can be heard saying, "No, please save me just this once, and I can't breathe." That video, Ritchie said, was deleted moments before Park called 911 and later recovered. Officers formed the conclusion that his consent was revoked when he asked her to save him. Ritchie said, "Park left him when she knew he was distressed and failed to release him." Ritchie was also noted that Nam was not bound when first responders arrived, leaving medical personnel unaware of what had happened to him. The bindings were later found in a bag behind a washing machine, which Ritchie said detectives interpreted as a sign of attempted deception by Park. Those interviews and others conducted by police at the couple's home and at a police station were key in the case. The district court initially ruled most of Park's statements could not be used against her, finding officers had effectively detailed her, but had not informed her of her Miranda rights. They also continued their questioning after Park asked for a lawyer. The judge found, and implied, she would be treated with leniency if she spoke with them. The Iowa Court of Appeals later partially reversed that decision, and in 2023, the Iowa Supreme Court overturned it entirely, ruling that all the interviews had been legally conducted. Defense attorney Tammy Gentry said Thursday she believes Park could have offered defenses of justification and battered women syndrome at the trial, but that she was giving up those claims to take advantage of the plea deal.
Thank you, Ella. Also from the front page of the Des Moines Register, a large image showing what we all remember from April, which is the Drake Relays. This image says, Valley's Dornkamp breaks Drake Relays record in 3,000. The picture shows a young woman running at the Drake Relays. And the caption says, West Des Moines Valley's Addison Dornkamp won the girls' 3,000-meter run Thursday at the Drake Relays, finishing with a time of 9:23.69, breaking a 10-year-old Drake Relays record. Pella's Marissa Fairby placed second with a time of 9:42.89. We'll get more coverage of the Drake Relays in the sports section. Also from the front page, Papa John art collection expected to fetch millions. Pieces will be auctioned at Christie's in New York. And the article says, over his 94 years, Des Moines entrepreneur and philanthropist John Papa John and his wife Mary bought more than 300 pieces of artwork. Some were inexpensive, like The Resurrection, the first piece of art he purchased with Mary from fellow University of Iowa grad Keith Acapole. The couple bought the painting for $50 from a gallery in Des Moines a month after they married in 1961. At age 90, he told Iowa Magazine it still hung on the wall of his Florida home. Some pieces were pricey, including the first major work the couple purchased, a work from the artist Mark Rothko from 1969 that the Papa Johns bought for millions and then sold for, quote, many millions, he told Iowa Magazine. Now, some pieces from the John and Mary Papa John collection of art are going up for auction at at Christie's in New York City. John Papa John died last year in April, and his wife Mary died in March 2022. They left behind a legacy of art and entrepreneurship, donating millions during their lifetimes. In Des Moines, where John Papa John started his insurance business and later his venture capital endeavors, the couple donated 30-plus sculptures from their personal collection in 2009 to create the 4.4-acre Papa John's Sculpture Park downtown after they ran out of room on their lawn. After John graduated from the University of Iowa in 1952, he met Mary, a University of Minnesota graduate, at a church gathering. They married in 1961 and settled in Des Moines. The couple shared a love of art, his growing from a class he took on art appreciation and hers from her related art degree. So which pieces from the John and Mary Papa John collection are up for auction? At the May auction, the most anticipated work comes from Jasper Johns, titled 0-9, a sculpt metal and collage on canvas. The work was created in 1961 and is estimated to sell for $5 million to $7 million. Christie's describes the piece as, quote, iconic Jasper Johns, in which he uses layering to challenge formal notions of numerical symbols, end quote. Johns moved to his numbers stage of his work in the second half of his career. Untitled Number 7 by abstract artist Agnes Martin combines abstract expressionism and minimalism. Christie's experts expect it to sell for $3 million to $5 million. Martin painted the piece in 1996. The auction house anticipates, quote, Hanged Man, a neon tubing mounted on metal piece by Bruce Nauman, to sell for $4 million to $6 million. Nauman created the work, the second in a group of three, in 1985. Another piece up for auction is a travertine carving that artist Henry Moore created in 1969. Animal Form is expected to fetch $1.5 million at the auction. Visitors to the Des Moines Art Center will recognize another piece by Moore. Three-way piece number one, Points, which sits at the northeast corner of the Art Center's plaza. That piece was a gift from Principal Financial Group in honor of the Des Moines Art Center's 50th anniversary in 1998. In all, Christie's notes that six major pieces will be sold, as well as more during subsequent sales. These pieces go up for auction May 14th during the 21st Century Evening Sales and on May 16th during the 20th Century Evening Sale. Back to Ella.
The U.S. TikTok ban passed. How soon could you lose your account? The countdown starts now to see whether or not the social media app TikTok will be banned from app stores in the United States. TikTok has been under fire as members of Congress seek to force the social media to cut ties with its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. More than 1 billion people are active users of TikTok, and it is the fourth most used social media platform, according to Search Logistics. How soon could you lose your TikTok account, and did your representative support the prohibition? Here's everything you need to know about the likely TikTok ban. In March, 352 Democrats and Republicans supported legislation to ban the app in the U.S. House of Representatives. The legislation stalled in the Senate, where Democrats hold a majority. The House added modified language to enact a TikTok ban to a series of foreign aid bills in April. The bill included the TikTok ban passed on a 360-58 vote April 20th, according to the USA Today. The bill included the TikTok ban along with funding for foreign aid passed the Senate Tuesday. Supports of the legislation are adamant that TikTok possesses a national security risk because its parent company is based in China. The bill managed to receive bipartisan support after, in both chambers, the TikTok ban bill was tied with foreign aid for Ukraine and Gaza, as well as funding to Israel for weapons. Biden signed the $95 billion package Wednesday. Opponents of the ban are fearful of its implications on small business advertisements and free speech rights, but supporters are hopeful that TikTok will be sold before the ban goes into effect. TikTok has 9 months to sell and part ways with the Beijing-based parent company ByteDance, according to NBC News. This means the earliest the app could be banned would be January 2025. There could also be an extension to the sales requirement, giving TikTok 12 months or until April 2025, according to NBC News. TikTok has successfully challenged other restrictions in U.S. courts. "Rest assured, we aren't going anywhere," TikTok CEO Shao Zi Chu said in a video statement, pledging to mount a legal challenge. "The facts and the Constitution are on our side, and we expect to prevail again." All members of the Iowa delegation in Congress supported the ban. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican who represents Northeast Iowa, co-led the original House legislation to force the split between TikTok and ByteDance. She posted on social media Wednesday saying that time is up for TikTok after refusing in the past to cut ties with ByteDance. Both Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst said TikTok is connected to the Chinese Communist Party, creating a national security threat. Ernst posted on social media after the original House vote, saying the United States must take action to counter our adversary's influence in our homeland.
Thank you, Ella. Also from the Des Moines Register main section, Iowa regulators deny call to combine carbon pipeline permit requests. In a 2-to-1 decision, Iowa regulators Thursday rejected efforts to force Summit Carbon Solutions to consolidate 15 permit requests that make up the Ames Company's proposal to build an $8 billion carbon capture pipeline across Iowa and other nearby states. Summit, a spinoff of Iowa ag millionaire Bruce Rastetter's Summit Agricultural Group, initially filed a permit in 2021 to build a 690-mile stretch of the pipeline across Iowa. It would be part of a 2,500-mile, five-state project designed to capture carbon dioxide emissions from ethanol plants and transport them to a site in North Dakota to be sequestered deep underground. The federal government is offering generous tax subsidies for carbon pipelines, touted as a way of minimizing the climate impact of the renewable fuel. But opponents have raised an array of objections. Last month, Summit filed 14 additional permit requests to expand the project by 340 miles, picking up 17 POET, Poet and Valero ethanol plants that had planned to participate in competitor Navigator CO2 Ventures' $3.5 billion carbon capture pipeline. Navigator dropped the project last year, citing regulatory barriers. Opponents moved last month to require Summit to consolidate its hazardous liquid pipeline permit requests, saying the lateral pipelines to Poet and Valero ethanol plants involve many of the same participants are part of the same project and pose the same legal issues. The Sierra Club's Iowa chapter and the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation also asked the Utilities Board to reopen the record on Summit's pipeline proposal, which had been closed after an eight-week hearing last fall. The Farm Bureau raised technical questions about the size of the new pipeline trunks, pressure changes, and valve and pump station locations. Summit argued that opponents primarily sought to delay the project, which already has spanned 31 months. From the board, adding to already voluminous case record wouldn't help. In an order Thursday written by board members Eric Helland and Sarah Martz, the three-member panel denied the group's requests, saying that while there may be overlapping parties in the proceedings, the landowners likely will not be the same. The order also said the legal questions are different enough to warrant separate dockets. The board, quote, finds it to be unlikely that consolidation would expedite or simplify consideration of the issues involved. The opposite is true, Helland and Martz wrote, noting that Summit's original pipeline permit request is, quote, already one of, if not, the largest records that has been submitted to the board for its consideration, end quote. Quote, adding an additional 340 miles to the existing record would further add to the complexity of the proceeding, end quote, the order said, adding that questions the Farm Bureau posed are best answered in the individual permit dockets. The board said consolidating the permit requests would harm Summit's rights as well as the rights of landowners currently not part of the case. The board also said the individual permit request dockets allow landowners to, quote, more easily find the information they are looking for. From a dissenting member, consolidating cases would ensure most efficient pipeline route. In a dissent, board member Joshua Bearns said he would have granted the request to reopen the record given the large expansion Summit seeks. Quote, the board should demand that the route for a project of this size and magnitude be the product of comprehensive planning to ensure the final route is the most efficient to accomplish the project's objectives and to minimize the impact on Iowa landowners, end quote. Had a comprehensive evaluation been performed, perhaps the route proposed in this case makes the most sense without alteration. However, I believe that discussion should at least occur as the exercise is worth the time and effort, end quote. The projects have been controversial across the region. Critics have voiced concerns about pipeline safety and the project's impact on farmland and drainage tiles under fields, and have objected to Summit's proposed use of eminent domain to force unwilling landowners to sell the company access to their property. Quote, how dare the IUB say Summit Carbon's substantial rights would be impacted, Kim Junker, a landowner who opposes the pipeline, said in a statement. Quote, this is a slap in the face to every Iowan whose constitutional property rights have been violated for the last 3 years, end quote. Summit's 2021 permit request seeks to build a pipeline across 29 Iowa counties serving 12 ethanol plants. The additional 14 permit requests would cross 23 counties. Public information meetings for the new permits have not yet been set. Last year, Summit filed a permit to build a 31-mile lateral pipeline in Mitchell and Floyd counties serving another ethanol plant. The board also denied a request to consolidate that permit with the original project. In addition, the board on Thursday denied the Sierra Club's request to stay action on the additional permit request until the original permit is decided. Altogether, Summit proposes connecting 57 ethanol plants in Minnesota, Nebraska, and South Dakota to its pipeline, as well as those in Iowa and North Dakota. To Ella.
Demonstrations continue on campuses. As college protests over Israel's war in Gaza continued across the U.S. on Friday, Columbia University was negotiating with student demonstrators and soon-to-be graduates at the University of Southern California, grappled with the cancellation of their upcoming commencement ceremony. Students still occupied Columbia's West Lawn early Friday, despite a rumored midnight deadline to clear the area. The Ivy League school has been the epicenter of student war protests for more than a week, especially after the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, called the New York City Police Department and had more than 100 students arrested last Thursday. Since then, hundreds of students have set up similar encampments across the country, leading to a national debate over free speech on college campuses, as some Jewish students and administrators say the demonstrations have at times been sites of anti-Semitism. The student protesters have called on university officials to cut financial ties from Israel and Israeli companies, especially those benefiting from the ongoing war in Gaza. While the demonstrations have not led to any divestments, the week of protests have had broad impacts, forcing classes to move online and disrupting graduation plans. Donald Trump criticized the mostly peaceful protests Thursday, describing them as tremendous hate, and saying that the violence at a white nationalist rally in Virginia when he was president was, by comparison, a little peanut. While student protests have escalated at universities across the United States in recent days, they have been largely peaceful, with no known deaths and none of the violent clashes that were seen between white nationalists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017. University authorities have attempted to clear many of the protest encampments, saying they are often unauthorized and calling in police. About 500 demonstrators have been arrested in the past week. Some Republicans in Congress have accused university administrators of allowing Jewish students to be harassed during the protests, but activist groups have strongly denied that the protests are anti-Semitic. While they have acknowledged that hateful rhetoric has at times been directed at Jewish students, they insist that people who tried to infiltrate and malign their movement are responsible for any harassment. In remarks to media Thursday following the day's testimony in his criminal trial in New York City, Trump said Charlottesville was a little peanut, and it was nothing compared to, and the hate wasn't the kind of hate that you have here, repeating an assertion he made on his social media platform on Wednesday. A woman has run down by a car and killed during the clashes in Charlottesville, and Trump drew strong criticism in the days after the rally for equating white supremacists with counter-protesters and saying both sides were to blame. A year later, Trump denounced the violence in Charlottesville, writing on Twitter that the rally had resulted in senseless death and division, while condemning all forms of racism and violence. Trump, the Republican candidate for president in the November elections, also sought Thursday to place blame for the current campus protests on Democratic President Joe Biden. "This is tremendous hate, and we have a man that can't talk about it, because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand what's going on with our country, Trump said. Trump is currently on trial for allegedly falsifying business records related to a payment to a porn star to keep her silent about an affair prior to the 2016 election. He has denied wrongdoing. At Columbia University, students were given the option of virtual classes for the rest of the semester after protests forced the university to cancel in-person classes on Monday. The University of Southern California on Thursday announced it was canceling its main commencement ceremony for what it said were safety reasons. The decision came 10 days after administrators decided to bar valedictorian Asna Tabassum, who is Muslim, from delivering a commencement address. Other schools must soon decide whether to hold their commencement ceremonies as the spring semester winds down and graduations are scheduled for the weeks ahead. Meanwhile, hundreds of people have been arrested at protests this week on university campuses from California and Texas to Indiana and Connecticut. At Emerson College in Boston, more than 100 people were arrested and four officers were injured when police cleared an encampment. In Atlanta, officers arrested more than 25 people and used non-lethal bullets to disperse protesters at Emory University. One person was shocked with a stun gun after being taken to the ground by police. More than 50 people were arrested at pro-Palestinian demonstrations at the University of Texas in Austin, and at USC, police arrested more than 90 people in on-campus protests. The days-long demonstrations have all centered on the war in Gaza that has triggered by Hamas' incursion into South Israel on October 7th, when about 1,200 people, mostly civilians, were killed, and more than 240 people were taken hostage.
Thank you, Ella. This is still from the Des Moines Register. AI gun detection software coming to Western Iowa School District. A Western Iowa school district is set to use an AI-based gun detection platform as a means to combat gun-related violence. According to a news release from Zero Eyes, the company behind the AI technology, which holds a designation from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the company layers their gun detection and intelligent situational awareness software onto existing digital security cameras. Zero Eyes utilizes a human-verified AI gun detection model, employing specially trained U.S. military and law enforcement veterans to be staffed at their operations center 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to verify the existence of a threat. Should one be found, alerts are dispatched, including a visual description, gun type, and last known location, within 3 to 5 seconds from detection. Quote, "In this day and age, no school is immune to gun-related violence, whether they're rural or urban," said Tim Kuhl, superintendent of East Union Community School District. Continuing the quote, "Considering the rising shooting rates across the country, we are taking no chances. It is our priority to protect our community, and Zero Eyes offers an added layer of security to identify potential threats before it's too late," end quote. Coming to the East Union Community School District in Afton, which serves roughly 500 students, the news release did not specifically state when the system would go live. According to Zero Eyes, their platform has been deployed in thousands of buildings for hundreds of customers in over 35 states, including the U.S. Department of Defense, public school districts and universities, commercial property groups, places of worship, casinos, retail, and more. Quote, "It is disheartening to see school communities be plagued by senseless violence each and every day," said Mike Lahief, CEO and co-founder of Zero Eyes. Quote, "But there are steps schools can take to proactively secure their campuses. We are grateful to provide an additional layer of protection for the students and staff in the East Union and Murray Community School Districts." Also from the Des Moines Register, aid workers killed in strike remembered. Egyptian officials work to restart hostage deal talks. A solemn crowd gathered in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. on Thursday to remember the seven staffers for the aid group World Central Kitchen who were killed in a drone attack in Gaza, sparking a wave of renewed outrage in the Israeli military, or at the Israeli military. Jose Andres, the celebrity chef and founder of the organization, mourned the loss of seven members in the April 1st Israeli strike, people he called the best of humanity. Recounting the workers' lives and their paths to joining the organization, he choked up. One staffer, Jacob Flickinger, a 33-year-old dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada, was called T.O. Jacob by children in Acapulco, where he volunteered aid in the wake of a hurricane. Another, Damien Sobol, had a street named after him in Turkey in honor of his efforts to help after an earthquake. Seyfettin Saif Abu Taha, a 25-year-old Palestinian whose family flower business became the aid group's headquarters in Gaza, was texting his mother to ask whether she was asleep when he was killed, Andres said. Andres reiterated his demand for an investigation into the workers' deaths. Quote, I know we all have many unanswered questions about what happened and why. There is no excuse for these killings. None, he said. The official explanation is not good enough, and we still demand an investigation into the actions of the IDF. Even one innocent life taken is one too many, end quote. He urged leaders to lead by the same standards as the humanitarian workers. Quote, the fate of the many cannot be decided by the hateful and divisive actions of the few, he said. The celebration of life was held under the sweeping ceilings and stained glass windows of the cathedral and was punctuated with musical performances, including from famed cellist Yo-Yo Ma, second gentleman Doug Emhoff, Deputy Secretary of State Kirk Campbell, and Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, attended the ceremony. Three faith leaders of the Washington area, Imam Talib Sharif, Rabbi Susan Shankman, and Archbishop Wilton Cardinal Gregory, offered prayers in memory of the workers. The group of staffers, which also included British citizens John Chapman, 57, James Henderson, 33, and James Kirby, 47, and Lazawi Frankum, 43, of Australia, were killed after an Israeli drone struck their convoy carrying aid through a deconflicted zone in Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip. The drone hit the group as it left a warehouse after it unloaded more than 100 tons of aid in two armored trucks branded with World Central Kitchen's logo. The convoy had informed the IDF of its movements, according to the aid group. The organization halted its humanitarian aid efforts in Gaza, previously one of the largest in operation in the war-torn enclave, in response to the workers' deaths. The deaths fueled outrage at the IDF's conduct in its ongoing siege in Gaza, where more than 34,000 Palestinians have died since Israel launched a sweeping military operation in response to Hamas's surprise attack on Israeli border communities on October 7th. The UN said the World Central Kitchen staffer deaths brought the number of aid workers killed to at least 224. An Egyptian delegation in Israel for talks on Gaza hostages. An Egyptian delegation met Israeli officials on Friday, looking for a way to restart talks to end the war in Gaza and return the remaining Israeli hostages, an official briefed on the meeting said. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said Israel had no new proposals to make, although it was willing to consider a limited truce in which 33 hostages would be released instead of the 40 previously under discussion. Quote, there are no current hostage talks between Israel and Hamas, nor is there a new Israeli offer in that regard, the official said. What there is an attempt by Egypt to restart the talks with an Egyptian proposal that would entail the release of 33 hostages, women, elderly, and infirm, end quote. According to Israeli media reports, Israeli intelligence officials believe there are 33 female elderly and sick hostages left alive in Gaza, out of a total of 133 still being held by Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups. There was no decision on how long any truce would last, but if such an exchange were agreed upon, the pause in fighting would be, quote, definitely less than 6 weeks, the official said. The visit by the Egyptian delegation followed Israeli media reports of a visit to Cairo on Thursday by the Israeli Army Chief Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi and Ronen Bar, the head of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence service. Egypt, concerned about a potential influx of Palestinian refugees from neighboring Gaza if the war continues with the long-promised Israeli offensive into the southern city of Rafah, has taken an increasingly active role in the negotiations. Quote, "The Egyptians are really picking up the mantle on this. Egypt wants to see progress, not least because it's worried about a prospective Rafah operation," the official said. Qatar, the previous main broker, had increasingly been excluded, according to the official, after failing to respond to Israeli demands to expel Hamas leaders from its territory or curb their finances. Quote, "Qatar is still involved, but in a lesser capacity," the official said, continuing, "It's clear to everyone they failed to deliver, even when it came to expelling Hamas or even shutting down their bank accounts." Gaza baby rescued from dead mother's womb dies. A baby girl who was delivered from her dying mother's womb in a Gaza hospital following an Israeli airstrike has died, the doctor who was caring for her said on Friday. The baby had been named Sabrine Al-Rua. The second name means soul in Arabic. Her mother, Sabrine Al-Sakani, Al-Sheikh, was seriously injured when the Israeli strike hit the family home in Rafah on Saturday night. Her husband, Shukri, and their three-year-old daughter, Malak, were killed. To Ella.
U.S. key inflation gouge stays elevated in March. A key inflation measure rose sharply in March, further dampening hopes that the Federal Reserve will soon cut interest rates. An underlying gouge of price increases stayed elevated, and household spending increased dramatically again, possibly keeping inflation higher for longer. Consumer prices overall increased 2.7% from a year earlier, above February's 2.5% rise, but well below the 40-year high of 7% in June 2022, according to the Commerce Department's Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. On a monthly basis, prices increased 0.3% in line with the advance the prior month, the PCE index shows. A measure of core prices that excludes volatile food and energy items and that the Fed follows closely in increased 0.3% on a monthly basis, the same as in February. That kept the annual increase at 2.8%. The disappointing readings were largely expected after the Commerce Department said in Thursday's report on economic growth that core PCE inflation rose at an annual rate of 3.7% in the first quarter, more than 3.4% forecasters projected. The big gain was mostly the result of an upward revision of January's monthly increase to 0.5% from 0.45%. says economist Paul Ashworth of Capital Economics. Just a few weeks ago, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said the central bank would not overreact to worrisome inflation numbers in January and February. He suggested they could have been blips, and inflation still appeared headed toward the Fed's 2% target. His tone changed after another inflation measure out earlier this month. The Consumer Price Index revealed larger-than-expected gains in March. Overall inflation jumped to 3.5% from 3.2%, and the core reading stayed high at 3.8%. The prices of goods such as used cars, furniture, and appliances generally have fallen as pandemic-related supply chain snarls have resolved. But the cost of services, including rent, car insurance, and healthcare, have climbed higher, in part because of sharply rising wages tied to COVID-induced labor shortages. Last month, goods prices ticked up just 0.1% as the cost of vehicles and parts tumbled 0.6%. The cost of services jumped 0.6% transportation surged 1.6%, and financial services and insurance increased 0.5%. After the CPI report, Powell said it's likely to take longer than expected for the Fed to gain confidence that inflation is heading sustainably to the Fed's target. Futures markets that had anticipated the first decrease in the Fed's key interest rate in June and a total of three cuts this year now expect just one in September. Some economists still believe inflation can resume its prior downshift fairly quickly as a deadline in rent for new tenant leases begins to affect existing lease renewals and slowing wage growth restrains the rising cost of services. Household spending increased a hefty 0.8% after a similar rise the previous month. Personal income rose 0.5%, up from 0.3%. But Americans are drawing heavily from savings to help finance their purchases, a trend that's unlikely to persist. The personal savings rate, the share of income that households are shocking away, fell from 3.6% to 3.2% last month. That's the lowest since October 2022, and down from a pre-pandemic average of about 7%. Also in the Des Moines Register, Weinstein accusers devastated after conviction overturned. Women who accused Harvey Weinstein of abuse were stunned Thursday by the announcement that the movie Mongol's 2020 rape conviction had been overturned. The decision was made by the New York Court of Appeals, which found that the trial judge improperly let women testify who weren't part of the case. The allegations against Weinstein marked the watershed moment in the hashtag MeToo movement and spawned a mass reckoning in the entertainment industry around abuses of power and sexual assault. The case, which helped popularize the MeToo movement and spurred a reckoning in the entertainment industry, began in 2017 and led to a wave of allegations against the 72-year-old movie mongol. The 2020 rape conviction led to a 23-year prison sentence. The appeals court majority said that Judge James Burke incorrectly admitted testimony from women with allegations that were not part of the case, but rather irrelevant prejudicial and untested allegations of prior bad acts. Weinstein's conviction in New York stemmed from the accusations brought by Miriam, Mimi, Haley, and Jessica Mann. But additional accusers also testified about their allegations of sexual misconduct against Weinstein. Women called the new decision disappointing and unjust. Jessica Barth, who accused Weinstein of sexual misconduct after the 2011 Golden Globes, called the decision a tragic step backwards in a statement obtained by USA Today. It sets dangerous precedent, said Barth, founder of Voices in Action, a nonprofit that supports sexual assault survivors. Evidence of prior bad acts in order to prove a pattern of behavior is often allowed in criminal cases and should absolutely be allowed in sexual assault cases. The emotional and physical toll a trial takes on victims testifying in front of their rapist is unfathomable to anyone who has never had to endure that experience, especially when the justice system is stacked against victims, she continued. My thoughts are with all of the survivors who took the stand and face the possibility of having to do it again. More than 10 unnamed Weinstein survivors, known as the Silence Breakers, expressed their collective shock. The news today is not only disheartening, but it's profoundly unjust, the group said in a statement shared with USA Today by SKDK, a consulting firm that works with advocacy groups. At a news conference Thursday, Weinstein's attorney, Arthur Aidala, said he had spoken to his client, who was grateful and maintained his innocence. Adala said Weinstein was the victim of a negative popularity contest amid a Me Too movement that placed the mogul at its center. Today's decision is a major step back in holding those accountable for acts of sexual violence, Douglas H. Wigdor, a lawyer of 8 Weinstein accusers, said in a statement. Courts routinely admit evidence of other uncharged acts where they assist juries in understanding issues concerning the modus operandi or scheme of the defendant. The jury was instructed on the relevance of this testimony, and overturning the verdict is tragic in that it will require the victims to endure yet another trial. Weinstein will continue serving a 16-year prison sentence for a 2022 California conviction for rape.
Thank you, Ola. And still in the Des Moines Register main section, Trump team attacks story of ex-publisher Pecker. The eighth day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial gave the former president's legal team their chance to attack the story prosecutors told of Trump colluding with a tabloid executive to boost his 2016 presidential campaign. Former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker spent nearly the entire week testifying about an alleged scheme to catch and kill stories that could hurt Trump's 2016 electoral chances. Prosecutors allege Trump falsified the purpose of checks to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, in order to conceal a conspiracy to unlawfully interfere in the 2016 presidential election through a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. Trump has pleaded not guilty and also denies Daniels' claim that the pair had sex. Before the day's proceedings began, Trump told reporters that he wished his wife, Melania, a happy birthday while complaining about being stuck at the trial. He said he would join his wife in Florida after the trial wrapped up for the day. The former president has started to equivocate on whether he will testify in the hush money trial. Quote, I would if it's necessary, Trump said in a telephone interview Thursday with Newsmax. Trump lawyer Emil Bove focused on distancing Trump from the actions of Pecker and American Media Incorporated. He got Pecker to confirm the National Enquirer was running stories about Bill and Hillary Clinton before the August 2015 meeting Pecker described where he agreed to help the Trump campaign. Pecker also confirmed that The Guardian published an article in May 2015 about malpractice suits against Ben Carson, one of Trump's GOP primary opponents, a question potentially aimed at suggesting to the jury that Pecker's coverage of political issue wasn't shaped by Trump. Bove suggested the public knew Pecker was helping Trump, citing a Wall Street Journal article that ran days before the 2016 election that said, quote, since last year, the Enquirer has supported Mr. Trump's presidential bid, endorsing him and publishing negative articles about some of his opponents, end quote. He also got Pecker to confirm that self-interest powered his company's $30,000 payment for a story from a Trump Tower doorman that Trump fathered a child with a housekeeper even though AMI concluded the story was false. And Bove got Pecker to confirm that AMI didn't admit to a campaign violation in a non-prosecution agreement Pecker signed. The company did pay $187,500 civil penalty as part of a separate agreement not to contest having committed a violation. That's an important issue for the defense because in order for Trump to be convicted on felony charges, prosecutors have to prove Trump not only falsified business records, but that he did so to commit or conceal another crime. One of the prosecution's theories is that Trump was trying to conceal that he violated federal campaign finance laws by making the hush money payment. Cohen pleaded guilty in 2018 to a violation of federal campaign contribution limits for making the payment. And final story from the Des Moines Register main section, Blinken confronts China over backing Russia's war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken raised concerns on Friday about China's support for Russia's military, one of the many issues threatening to sour the recent improvement in relations between the world's biggest economies. Blinken raised the matter during 5.5 hours of talks with China's top diplomat Wang Yi in Beijing, the latest high-level contact between the countries that have eased last year's acrimony. Quote, I reiterated our serious concern about the PRC providing components that are powering Russia's brutal war of aggression against Ukraine, Blinken said at a press conference at the end of his visit on Friday, using China's official name, the People's Republic of China. Underscoring the closeness of the Beijing-Moscow relationship, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu met his Chinese counterpart, Dong Jun, on Friday and said the two countries were working to strengthen their, quote, strategic partnership in the defense sector. Despite its no-limits partnership with Moscow, China has steered clear of providing arms for Russia's war in Ukraine, but Blinken said its supply of so-called dual-use goods was, quote, having a material effect in Ukraine and raising the threat Russia poses to other countries in Europe. China has said it has not provided weaponry to any party, adding that it is, quote, not a producer of or party involved in the Ukraine crisis. However, it says that normal trade between China and Russia should not be interrupted or restricted. Blinken's visit produced little progress on other contentious issues, including U.S. complaints about cheap Chinese exports and tensions over Taiwan and the South China Sea. Instead, both sides were focusing on issues such as people-to-people exchanges. In addition to his talks with Wang, Blinken met Chinese President Xi Jinping, who reiterated Beijing's concerns that the United States was suppressing its economic development. Quote, this is a fundamental issue that must be addressed just like the first button of a shirt must be put right in order for the China-U.S. relationship to truly stabilize, improve, and move forward, she said. Earlier, Wang told Blinken that the, quote, giant ship of the China-U.S. ties had stabilized, but, quote, negative factors in the relationship are still increasing and building. Quote, and the relationship is facing all kinds of disruptions. China's legitimate development rights have been unreasonably suppressed, and our core interests are facing challenges, Wang told Blinken. The agenda for the talks was set during the November summit between Biden and Xi in San Francisco and a follow-up call in April. Blinken, along with senior U.S. officials focused on anti-narcotics collaboration with China, met China's Minister of Public Security, Fang Xiaohong, to discuss the fentanyl issue. Blinken told the news conference that China had made some progress on the issue, but said that, quote, more needs to be done. And now back to Ella for more local news.
To Metro in Iowa, Hawkeye State offers world's largest things. Have you ever stopped to think about where the world's largest bullhead is? Maybe the world's largest Cheeto? What about the world's largest wooden nickel? Well, you're in luck because Iowa is home to 14 of the world's largest things. Here's a list and where you can find them. Albert, the world's largest bull. Have you ever met Albert, the 28-foot-tall sire in Audubon, is one of Iowa's small-town celebrities. The 40-ton concrete blue-eyed stud was built in 1964, making him one of the oldest concrete bulls, too. You can't forget what makes a bull, either. He does have massive gonads. Around 1 hour and 20 minutes west of the metro, Audubon is a small town of about 2,000, right off Interstate 44. Albert brings around 20,000 visitors every year. The world's largest bullhead. If you grew up fishing in Iowa's lakes, you've probably come across these not-so-tasty bottom dwellers. Crystal Lake, Iowa is home to the 12-foot-long cousin of the catfish. About a half hour west of Clear Lake, Iowa, the fish, which was built in 1958 and restored in 2007, sits right at the edge of Crystal Lake. The world's largest Cheeto. If you've ever been eating Cheetos, pulled one out, and said, wow, this has got to be the world's largest Cheeto, you are probably wrong. The world's largest Cheeto is in Algona. Originally found in a bag of Cheetos, Elwood was in... Nope, hold on. Excuse me. Elwood, the world's largest concrete gnome. Meet Elwood. Excuse me. I lost my place. Originally found in a bag of Cheetos in Hawaii by Navy officer Mike Evans in 2003, the Cheeto was originally on eBay. Eventually, the Cheeto was rehomed after local radio DJ Bryce Wilson started a campaign to bring it to Iowa. Though not as intact as it used to be, you can visit the world's largest Cheeto in Algona, about an hour west of Interstate 35. Now to Elwood, the world's largest concrete gnome. Meet Elwood, the concrete gnome that resides in Iowa State University's Raymond Gardens. Sculpted by Andy and Connie Kautza of National Rock and Sculpture in Wausau, Wisconsin, Elwood was installed and dedicated in 2010. Elwood was intended to be the world's largest gnome, but during his construction, a larger gnome was found in Poland. So Elwood is known as the world's largest concrete gnome. Named after the original state Raymond Gardens was located on, Elwood is located in Ames, which is right off of Interstate 35. The world's largest garden trowel. The world's largest garden trowel used to call the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City home. Then in 2004, it was moved to Des Moines to celebrate Meredith Corp's 100th anniversary. Built in 2001 by artists Claes Oldenburg and Kusse van Bruggen, the aluminum, plastic, and steel trowel stands at 23 feet tall and weighs 2,300 pounds. That's a lot of trowel. The world's largest golden spike. Originally installed in 1939 for the premiere of the movie Union Pacific in Omaha, Nebraska, the 56-foot-tall spike holds the record for the world's largest golden spike. It stands tall beside the Union Pacific Railroad Museum in Council Bluffs. Council Bluffs has a long history with the railroad as a mid-century stop of the road was finished in 1869 and still serves the U.S. today as the second-largest railway in the country. The world's largest man-made grotto. Known to Iowans as the eighth wonder of the world, the Grotto of Redemption in West Bend is the only thing on this list that is also on the National Register for Historic Places. Construction began on this football field-sized grotto in 1912 by Father Paul Matthias Doberstein of Germany. Built of precious gemstones like jasper, quartz, and amethyst, the entire grotto is estimated to have $4.3 million worth of stones and crystals. Some 100,000 tourists come to the small town of West Bend with a population of less than 1,000 to see the grotto every year. Some come for religious reasons, while others come to see the grotto itself. West Bend is around an hour west of Interstate 35 in northern Iowa. The world's largest Pocahontas. Perhaps unironically, the world's largest Pocahontas is located in Pocahontas. Built in 1956, the Pocahontas stands 25 feet tall and 7 feet wide, made completely out of concrete. Known as the, quote, world's largest Indian maiden monument, unquote, by the World Record Academy, she can be found just over an hour west of Interstate 35. In northern Iowa. Don't worry, she isn't too hard to find.
And as we near the end of the hour, we move on to birthdays.